I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. We've heard countless brilliant ideas on the show from activists, entrepreneurs, and policymakers that have truly inspired us. We recognize, though, that having a brilliant idea is only half of the battle. Implementing ideas, it's its own challenge.
That's why this week we're speaking with an expert on implementation. Mara Carabello is the president and founder of the Exoro Group and is the most influential person you've never heard of. With her broad background as an activist and political consultant, Mara is an expert in building coalitions and helping policy advocates achieve their goals. We ask her to give us the 101 on how to get things done.
Here is Mara.
Great. I'm Mara Carabello. I am currently the owner of a public policy firm called the Exoro Group. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah. My path to where I am today started out actually in the nonprofit world. I had assumed that my degrees are in behavioral psychology, which I say as an aside, if you want to be in public policy and work with elected officials, you should probably get a degree in behavioral psychology. And then political science, because I just always loved it. But I never thought I would practice it, to be honest. And I started out doing advocacy work. I worked in Uganda during the height of the AIDS epidemic. I have run a couple of small nonprofits doing reverse medical goods and services. And then we may bring this up later, but I was also the first executive director of the Gun Violence Prevention Center in Utah. At the same time, I had worked on a couple of projects with some big companies. It was a mentoring project, but I was based in New York and we worked with Fortune 50 companies, which led me to this decision that I loved advocacy, but I wanted issues to change and maybe help others with their agenda, and led me to starting a public policy firm 18 years ago. So that's a little bit of where I come from.
Wonderful broad background. And that's one of the reasons I think we're interested in hearing from you, is that we so often speak to theorists and economists or people with new solutions, and we're kind of interested in how does it go from kind of concept of how to, like, a green energy source or, you know, some new idea of economics to actual implementation on the ground that makes a difference. And as someone in a red state with some pretty blue ideas, we'd just love to hear your perspective.
I love that question. I have, the more I'm in public policy, I think the more I move to being a realist, if you will, versus an idealist. I love both sides of the spectrum, and we need roles at different time. But as I have been, as you suggest, I'm a progressive left of center person working in a red state. And I'm going to maybe really get tactical then, or applied or practical in this discussion. And one of the first things that I approach, there are two things when I talk to a client or when I talk to an activist about meeting their goals that anchor my thinking. The first one is, and they're fundamental, right? You hear these things and they're fundamental. Don't define, or don't wait to win to define success. So I find that people often wait until the end and they say, oh, here's what success, that I win this campaign, I pass this piece of legislation. I would suggest that decide you're succeeding when you take the action, because that's the truth of it. When you formulate, whether it's an idea or a group of people willing to take action, or a willingness to call a legislator, or a willingness to write a letter to the editor, define success from the very first step you take. Choose major milestones along the way, right? Certainly choose major milestones. And always, this philosophy is not one that aims short. This philosophy aims very high, but it defines success from day one. You need that mentality if you are actually going to cross the finish line. So first is, like, get your head game about defining success as bringing one more person to understanding your point of view. It is the letter to the editor. The more you work in even paid political hacks like me, the more you believe that one individual action is actually the answer to the question. So define success as when you start to take an action, and then pick major milestones, but continue to define success. The other, I think, fundamental is decide why you're doing what you're doing. We start with every client saying, we need to know your objective. And inevitably, the client repeats the goal or the tactic they've asked us to achieve. And we're saying, yeah, But why? Why be seeking clarity on what you want? Let me give some examples of two really good things to seek. One is speaking truth to power. This is about activism at its raw form. You want to be heard. You want to be seen. You want to lay claim to voices that you don't feel like are heard. There's so much power in that. I'll differentiate that, though, from a goal of making change and enacting a specific ordinance or enacting a piece of legislation. Be clear on what you seek to do. And organizations and efforts that wave in and out of those goals, sort of they're speaking truth on one point, but then they also want a specific person to take a specific action, often use the wrong tools at the wrong time and the wrong tactics, and they are developing their brand in the wrong way, so to speak. So I say, you know, get clarity on that. Really dig deep and say, why am I doing what I'm doing and what do I want to achieve at the end? Particularly, which side am I speaking truth right now or am I making change? And then you'll decide who your audiences are, what your path is, and your power gets bigger and bigger because you have clarity. And as with all that we do, that also allows you to say, you can't do everything at one time. I must have a clear path forward. I'm going to make that change to move on to others. And as business entrepreneurs and as thinkers know, we should think broadly, but we have to master individual things at a time. And so I would say those who want to, whether they're seasoned or not, we all have to really define success from the beginning, but really seek clarity on what it is we want to achieve.
Yeah, I love that framework. It's almost like a personal coaching to activism, you know, because or to coach the overwhelm of activism, all these things which are out there to be active about and get active about. But one thing which I get really intrigued when you say seeking the truth or speaking the truth.
Truth to power.
The truth, what?
Truth to power.
Truth to power. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there seems to be a lot of truths out there for a lot of people. How do you tackle that? You know, everyone says, oh, that's my truth. And, you know, we just had this election thing. So what is the truth? How do you get to what is the truth?
That's a great question. I'm going to answer it from a change position. So I'm going to sidestep perhaps a little and you can call me on that and we can come back to the start. But I think one of the things that we all need to pay attention to in the United States is the axiom that language matters and that and precision in language. And what we're seeing right now in the public marketplace is a propensity to be hyperbolic, to be pithy, because that's how we're consuming information. Politics really does reflect us. We like to think that the politic is the problem and not us, but we decide what to consume. And so we want short bites. You know, I used to read, now I skim. We are choosing that. And so I'm going to say, when you land on truth, a couple things. If you're an advocate, you can either choose to seek to get attention, to get likes, to get movement. And as I said, if that seeks your goal, if that fits into your goal, great. I think the deeper perspective there is, did you really persuade somebody? I like the word persuasion. I think, unfortunately, it often gets tackled with some manipulation. I'm not speaking of it as a manipulation. I mean, I've done a terrific job making my case for support. And yet, when I make my case for support, I also, it's incumbent on me to tell the truth, because I believe that my truth will win the day. So I'm going to go back to my first point about language matters. Accuracy does matter. And so I find that those who are most successful in speaking truth to power and perhaps changing opinions are the ones who don't get the short-term accolade. They're perhaps not the best soundbite, but they have built credibility because they continuously use language that is open, use language that other people can find positions in. We've seen really great statespeople in which you can listen to them and you can disagree with them, but you can respect them because of the integrity of their truth. So that's what pure public policy at its finest is. I would say to those advocates who have a way with words and maybe even are clever, use that finely, because that is degrading somewhat of our conversation. Really great truth is when I can speak with my passion, but I don't create distance with you. I don't off-put with you. You can hear me. You could disagree with me. But wow, the power in having someone continuing to listen to you. What we're all doing now is I hear people and I stop listening because of their language choice. Because this happens to people who even I'm like-minded with. I'm sort of shutting down because of their language choice. So real truth digs a little deeper and it is has an honesty and accuracy to it and a passion. It doesn't choose between it. We hear passion a lot now, and it sometimes lacks accuracy.
It sounds like authenticity is actually maybe a more authentic term for what we're talking about.
Right. And authentic truths. I mean, again, you listen to those people. Having your audience not shut down on what you're saying is just incredible. And right now, the polarization we're seeing is because we don't care, really. Like, I'm talking to my bucket, you're talking to your bucket, and we're just whooping each other up, and we sort of don't care anymore whether those people, and it's because we've projected a lot on them. They are these things and these people, and I don't want to talk to them. I just say, wow, well, then you're never going to make change. I mean, I don't originate in Utah, and bless my family. They will some say, how are you doing advocacy in this state? And part of me wants to say, I don't need to advocate my agenda in Boulder, Colorado. Like I need, you must talk to people who aren't like you. That's definitionally change, right? That's where the interesting conversation happens. But if you do that, you have to dig a little deeper and you have to sort of let off steam with your friends and family, but really come with a sense of discourse to the table. And when you get there, the productivity of it will encourage you, even if their point of view will discourage you in some ways.
Such an interesting conversation, I think. You know, talking about truth, there's also a lie. Right? And at the moment, we have these lies become bigger and bigger, and they certainly survive liars. And that is very damaging, I think, society. And this what Mel was just saying about polarization. I have no idea how to get rid of a lie as big as it is.
Yeah, I mean, you're bringing up a good point in which facts are facts. And we've come to reject that in the last 4 years. But they are. And one thing, so I'll be a little hyper-political for a moment. I'm an unaffiliated voter now because of some of what you're saying. I believe that we've chosen brand over subject matter. I believe we have chosen brand over conversations. I mean, if we look at the political parties, they've switched positions several times. And we have chosen to sort of blindly follow a brand that takes no buy-in. I mean, I don't know what it is to be these things. I mean, I do at the moment of the day, I do, because they're defining themselves. But I think one of the key parts of truth and lies is, let's be honest about, are we following a brand? We've become so programmed, or are we really listening and following our truth on an issue? And I can look at them, someone, and say, I don't agree with those four things, but that fifth thing that she said, that is truth. And I'm going to have the strength to, in my peer group, stand up and say, I believe her on that. And I'm going to start voicing belief in ideologic issues, value-based issues, and truth-based issues. I'm going to reinforce fact, whether it's fact that supports my worldview or not, whether it's fact, I'm going to honor fact regardless of who says it, regardless of what their brand is. And it's harder. You're at dinner, well, non-COVID times, you're at dinner with a group of friends. It's really hard to say, to not just fall into, ugh, don't you hate so? I'm talking about public people, right? And saying, no, you know, they're telling the truth at that moment. You feel like a schmo when you do that. But we need to start. If we want to honor that truth and fact are more important, then we have to give up our brands a little bit and go with truth and fact on that.
That makes a lot of sense. It feels like football team fans to me, you know, if you're blue or you're red, which team are you on? But if we could go back to this idea of practical change, like how we actually manifest change. And one of the questions I have for you as such a longtime advocate activist is kind of historical. It felt like in the 70s, the environmental movement, let's say, and a lot of progressive ideas were really making progress. There was a huge consciousness around environmentalism. You know, we fought against fossil fuels. And then along the way, we seem to have dropped out, the bottom dropped out of that, and we kind of forgot about, or felt like collectively, not individuals, but collectively, there was a hiatus of about 30 years where those issues just were not front and center the way they were. And I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, and what is bringing people back, and how is it growing, and what is the trend that you see from that time to now to perhaps in the future?
That's a great question. It's a big question. I think on some issues, the trend, well, I am seeing a trend. We see statistically that the youth are engaging, and we need to change our attitudes about that. We also need to differentiate between what engagement is. One thing that we're lacking currently is, you know, liking something on a Facebook page actually isn't an action. It does not do anything. I mean, it's lovely, and you know, it creates community. I shouldn't dismiss it, but we're. We're so unwilling to be uncomfortable at all, right? Let's take an easy thing in recycling. For most of us, recycling is sort of built into some system I have. But, you know, those 10 extra steps, we've become so indulged, and will we sacrifice for anything? So that the one notion I think that is coming back is the younger generation will take an action. We need to make sure those actions are true actions. They're not just electronic actions. So part of it is we need to ask ourselves to do more. And we really have to get back to this notion of self-determination and self-sacrifice, because we tend to work in collective notions. Oh, yes, I collectively agree to that. But what am I doing, right? I still have my car and I'm still taking a single passenger trip. But oh yeah, collectively, I totally agree with air quality and NOx emissions reduction. But you know, what am I doing? So really, so conceptually, as a person, I think we have to start taking stock of not only the value systems we've created, but if we have not associated action with us, we need to call on that. And I think that showed up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It even showed up as a determination of wartime efforts. Right? They left ideological terms, they moved into action-based terms. And again, I see advocacy groups working up our ideological framework, but not giving us things to do. So let's talk about that. One of the big deterrents in an informed society that we have now, access to so much information, it's overwhelming. Which do I do first? And if I buy an electric car, I saved some emissions, but I also increased the carbon that it took to make the car. So is that a better choice? Is it a worse choice? I'm overwhelmed. So those of us who are those of you who are experts in areas, you've got to simplify a little bit. And we talk about three main things that make great public policy. And I think we've moved away from this. One is personalization. And personalization doesn't mean, oh, your listener is selfish. It means you have to fit it into their world. Always answer for the listener. We speak a lot from our sort of heightened, you know, superior place of advocacy. We've spent generations on this issue. We need to remember that the communication in public is about the listener, not about us. So personalize it for the listener. I think the second one we talk about a lot is simplification. And when I say simplification in your speech making, in your messaging, it doesn't mean dumbing down. And I don't like when people go there. Simplification is choosing poetry over prose. It is much harder to write 10 words than it is to write 5 paragraphs. And we've moved into writing 5 paragraphs, particularly the passionate who believe that the cause has major consequences. I mean, the environment has this relationship where the concern is so high. The 5 paragraph isn't reaching through and grabbing. You have to really spend the time to decide what the applicable 10 words are, so to speak, 10 being, you know, not magic. And then the third component, so if you personalize it and you simplify it, is choosing imagery. We've moved away. When you speak of the eras of major active times, they did such a lovely job creating universal images. Images are so nice because you and I can, I'm going to use an easy one, a flag. You know, let's, for this conversation, let's say the American flag. You and I can both have a positive reaction to it, and it's a very different reaction. But I can band together with you behind this symbol, and I don't have to go through the descriptions of it. We have to create the positive symbols that create the environment that everyone can join. And we have to stop with the, unless you're 10 on 10 on my issue, you can't, you're not, you know, you're not good enough, unless you completely agree. And I think it sounds so simple, but we've become really complicated, and we've become, here's the 20 things you can do in my area. It's overwhelming to me. And then I feel like a lightweight because I'm just trying to figure out my kid's schedule, or I'm selfish and I don't, like, we have to stop creating these almost information barriers. And if we can tell someone why it impacts them or their world or their family or their community, the personalization, and we can make it simple enough that I can absorb it on my phone while I'm doing something else in some ways. And then if we can bind behind images or universally felt things, then we make this community that's not defined by politics and not defined by where I live and not defined by my age or my gender or anything else about me, but this shared goal.
Yeah, that sounds like the image I have of the effective advocacy in the 70s is of the crying Indian, right? The crying a Native American, we would say now, but before it was that bit was entitled The Crying Indian. And it was such a powerful image of the destruction of the land and a reaction, and everything changed. I mean, it really did cause amazing change after that campaign. Can you give examples of where we are today that have effective campaigns?
So I'm gonna start with some negative ones for me. I think one of the keys to success of the NRA has been their use of imagery, and I think it's really negative. I think it's disingenuous, but they're using imagery well, and we, you know, they counter that. You have some, there are some national preservation groups. I mean, the World Wildlife Fund uses imagery. I mean, animals, the natural environment lends itself. And again, what imagery transcends is we can come to the action from very, very different paths, right? Because we could all start to make our own behavioral changes for very different reasons. That's why it's so, so impactful. Good question. I'm trying to think of others. I sadly don't know that I think many national groups are using this. I can think of several local groups. There have been some members of the LGBT community when they go into their broader support, you know, like PFLAG, and you're looking at those of us who are supporting them. They are sometimes using these broad family contexts, and yet they're bringing up. Those are so powerful because let's keep using that LGBTQ notion about owning the imagery of family allows me to come from a very progressive place or a very conservative place. And yet what we're valuing is connection and knitting people. And that transcends all that hard language in the middle, right? Of trying to reach someone not in your sphere. And so that community has often done really powerful campaigns. Land preservation, I think, is a tremendous area, because I say land preservation because in some ways it's a very specific area in environmentalism. But those who want to save and protect and use land are both recreators and naturalists and environmentalists, but they're also users, they're skiers, they're hikers, and they have a lot of room in there to come together. So you see lovely localized campaigns about land use management. Those are some ideas that come to mind. The tougher ones become around violence or abuse or, you know, police imagery right now is really a tough one. And it's in part because clearly we're not showing respect and we're not finding universal imagery around achieved goals. We're in a combative ideological battle that's real. It's, you know, I lay credibility to it, but we're not transcending right now. So that's what comes to mind.
This is really more related to our particular area, which is, you know, drilling down into the root causes of some of these economic and environmental hardships that we're facing, right? And so for us, root causes turn out to be economic, largely. You know, how our system is designed, what it encourages, what it discourages. And, you know, we struggle ourselves with how do we capture that advocacy or that role of just laying bare or making transparent these root causes in economic terms. Any advice for us?
Right. I mean, I would agree that that's the real work to be done. I maybe am going to give a suggestion on the applied side, in which where I've been leaning more and more is in an ideal decision-making environment and public policy for me, is we need to give our decision makers room, our policy makers room to make decisions. Because what's happening now when we look at these basic issues, as you say, let's take economics, which are entrenched in 200 years of programming that has been discriminatory, and you really are dredging up so much there that how do you start? And one of the things that has happened is we've created such a punitive environment for those who are elected, in which if they make we're reinforcing things like blue ribbon commissions and even roundtables that show diversity. And I've become a little wary of just getting us all at a table and having the conversation. For me, part of pushing through, as Mel, you suggested really well, pushing through, would be to say, how about if we create a space where we can also give people a little more room to make a decision and correct a failed decision? So I'm going to go with like really a basic economic principle. And in one of the underserved populations, there's not access to money or lending or resources. You know, we think of the bootstrap thing. Well, we didn't do that, right? That's generational entitlement. And so we say to whomever our decision maker is, you need to change this. And what they tend to do is gather people. And we research things and gather. Research and gathering people are essential. But change happens when decisions are made. And again, I want to differentiate, all components of this process are critical. But we have to give our decision makers enough room to make decisions. And where the accountability should be is, do they course correct when it doesn't change what we want it to change? Right now, what we're punishing for is making the wrong decision. And in that state, they'll never make it. They'll always go with the blah middle that doesn't change anything but feels good and sounds good. We have to give them, and that's about measurables. We have to give them permission to make decisions, and where the accountability lives is in changing that decision, modifying it, altering it, when it doesn't meet the collective metrics that we've described. And I think that's where we've got it wrong right now, where we are reinforcing to not make a hard decision because they're going to lose, right? We're going to hold them accountable for the decision. We need to be holding them accountable for changing bad decisions. And if they make that change, if they're willing to pivot, we should reward that. Because what we want is change, right? What you're saying is, how do we move to real decision-making and change of systems that have been this way? So we are going to have to pick at them with our axe for a long time.
Anything as a last word, as the last thing you would like to say we haven't mentioned or we haven't asked you?
You know, I'm going to go back to really individual and granular a little. When COVID lifts, and it will someday, I'm going to say stick to the fundamentals, build relationships, don't just go and talk at them. Language matters and nonverbal matters. And when we do a lot of speech training, and I remind people that 80% of our communication is nonverbal. Only about 20% is what we say. I say, you know, and most of it is just how we interact. So are we open really physically? Are we making eye contact? What a show of respect it is to be present for someone. So to those of you who are seasoned change makers or just starting, the power of connecting and moving beyond your own sphere is just enormous.
Yes. What a wonderful thought, right? And good advice for all of us.
The power of connection.
Well, it's great to have a unique perspective on what it takes to actually produce results, right? I mean, some of the pointers she gave were really important. Like, you know, take small progress and just, you know, if you're going to act and think about an idea or advocate an idea, just picking up the phone is a success. You know, taking the action really should be celebrated every step of the way. I think a lot of times activists get burned out because they fight and fight and fight, and then the results don't come as fast as they would like. And so it makes
and there are
a difference.
Huge barriers, you know, like as we were talking about the truth and the lie thing, the huge barriers, like how to get to that truth and who's accepting facts. I mean, there are people out there who still believe there is no climate change happening in this world, right? And actively stand for it and make it their, yeah, whatever they do in their lives. It's just ignoring that we have massive changes or that we are confronted with massive changes in our society.
Right, but she offers a like kind of antidote to that as well, which is, and I loved this, because we do tend to be all or nothing people increasingly over time. And I think by her saying, you know, don't wait for the 10 out of 10. Look for something, create a relationship, look for something around which you can agree and build from there. I mean, I think that's what she was saying, basically.
Which is a lot more than just being able to disagree. You know, I think this is already missing already, you know, a bit that we are, it seems like even politically or on a lot of other levels, it's like hard to just have a disagreement in the room. But what Maura says, it's actually, it's next level. It's actually more than just not disagreeing.
Yeah, no, it's actually figuring out a path of walking together forward somehow.
It has to do with listening. And there was also this, when she talked about the, you know, you talked about the collective action and the self, what was the term?
The personal action.
Yes. And I would, what resonated with me is this connection to ourselves. Yeah, and it's so important to have this kind of self center. You like rest in yourself and find peace within yourself first, and like declutter whatever you have to declutter, to say, complete your incompletes and all that, and then move out of this center forward, whatever you want to do and whatever your purpose is in life.
I mean, I guess I could say that as someone who's been a longtime community activist, both in the LGBT world and in the local community, a lot of what she says rings true. Like, you know, to take satisfaction on the small little steps, because it's a long haul a lot of the time, and actually bringing people to see a common vision is important, even if people disagree. And, you know, like finding those core values that we can all start with. And I think that's, you know, for me, a lot of what she said resonates with producing results, and also some of the things that I've learned myself about, you know, like just strip away the kind of noise or the concrete results you're talking about at first, and get to what I say core principles. And she was saying, why are you doing this? Like, get to strip away down to the why are you doing this? Are you doing this to make that change? Are you doing this for that vision? Are you doing this just to get to the truth of a matter or tell that to someone? And that's a very, very clear, simple, straightforward, helpful hints for getting stuff.
Which very much aligns, very much is whether you live your purpose in life. And there is not, you know, you can't be more in the center of the truth if you live your life's purpose.
Yeah, authenticity all the way.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at podofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.